I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Elise Frischman, a prominent American Reform rabbi, editor of the Reform prayer book Mishkan Tefillah, and recently in the news after being detained by Israeli police for praying in a tallit at the Western Wall with the Women of the Wall. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Last week, Israel held elections for the Knesset, the parliament of the country, which includes the prime minister, of course, and the results were not exactly what was anticipated. While all predictions were that Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu, at the head of the right-wing Likud party, would win a solid victory, the final election tally was actually a flat-out draw, a kind of tie between left and right. Netanyahu's coalition of Likud and Yisrael Beitenu, an even more right-wing allied party of Likuds, won 42 seats out of the 120 in the Knesset, down a surprising 11 or so from its showing in the last election. The left-center coalition of the ancient Labor Party, the brand-spanking-new Yesh Atid Party, that means there is a future, Meretz, and two other small parties, including the remnants of Kadima, won 48 seats. And the two ultra-Orthodox parties, including the Sephardic party Shas and the supposedly dynamic United Torah Judaism led by Naftali Bennett, won their typical 18 seats. Arab parties won 12 seats, about average for them. 61 votes are needed to form a new government in the Knesset, one more than the majority, which means that counting votes after the election last night, the right now has 42 seats plus the likely adherence of the 18 ultra-Orthodox members, while the center-left has 48 seats plus the possible voting of the 12 Arab members who have never actually been part of any governing coalition in Israel. That looks about like 60 votes against 60 votes, or more colloquially, a straight 50-50 split. Of course, this being Israeli politics, it's never that simple. And in actuality, it's much more likely that Bibi Netanyahu will be prime minister, governing with some kind of coalition of the right and the center, but with some possibility still of a narrow and somewhat shaky right-wing Orthodox coalition. What was anticipated before the elections was a pretty solid right-wing majority, and that did not happen. The big surprise was the meteoric rise of a new party, Yesh Atid, led by a handsome former newscaster, print and TV journalist, author and playwright, Yair Lapid. Lapid is also the son of a famed journalist and the leader of the secular Shinui party a while back, the late Tommy Lapid. For what it's worth, Yair Lapid is also a former amateur boxer and is considered one of the sexiest men in Israel. Hoo-ha. So, what does Lapid want in Israeli politics? Well, in his own words,
we are the party of the Israeli middle class, the old-fashioned taxpayers who served in the army and afterwards worked hard all their life, paying a high tax, and see that they cannot afford an apartment to their children, and the cost of living is going up and up, and there's no equality of burden with the other parts of Israeli society, and they're becoming more and more frustrated with the way things are going around here, domestic-wise.
Yair Lapid formed his new party about a year ago, and it only received its official name last April. Its platform is primarily about economic fairness to the Israeli middle class, with a strong additional emphasis on universal conscription into the army, including the ultra-Orthodox. Plus, there are some anti-corruption commitments and a general belief in a two-state solution. Out of this less-than-shocking array of causes, plus a whole roster of new and often handsome faces, it is now the second-largest voting bloc in the Knesset, having won a fairly stunning 19 seats. There is nothing comparable to this in American politics. Israel is different here. It's a little like what might have happened if Walter Cronkite had suddenly decided to run for president in 1972 and won 15% of the vote, and then was chosen Secretary of State as a trade-off in order to bring his voters back into one party or the other. Or if today John Stewart suddenly announced his candidacy for president, got a slate of candidates like him elected, perhaps his whole reportorial staff and his comedy writers, and then was made vice president. But even this doesn't quite capture it. While Netanyahu will be the next prime minister, and he is a very old hand at manipulating the complex Israeli political system to his own advantage, the next most powerful guy in Israel is sort of Yair Lapid. Until last year, when he left his very successful journalism career to enter politics, Lapid had never held political office, had never run for a public office, actually, and now the first guy Bibi Netanyahu called after the election was Yair Lapid. Everyone in Israel is sure this will remake Israeli politics and open up a better, brighter tomorrow for all Israelis. You know, this for the moment makes him the second most powerful person in Israel. Yesh Atid, there is a future. By the way, a great deal of Yair Lapid's campaign was waged on Facebook and other social media sites. But a cautionary note. Unlike America over the past century and a half, Israel has had dynamic new third parties, sometimes even fourth parties, that have shaken up the political scene in the past. Often they come from unexpected places and make a big splash. But typically they fade pretty fast once they get some actual involvement in the nitty-gritty give and take of politics. The game of the possible tends to sand the edges off of the idealistic dreams of fresh political leaders quite quickly. It is conceivable that Bibi Netanyahu will create a coalition with Yesh Atid and, say, Tzipi Livni's Tenua party, which has 6 seats, or maybe the final 2 surviving Knesset members sworn to Kadima, the last new political party to take the Israeli public by storm, and leave out the Orthodox parties from his government altogether. This might work well on social issues and lead to a dramatic change in military service for the ultra-Orthodox. According to one of the new members of Knesset of the Yesh Atid list, any government it joins would have to pledge to begin drafting the ultra-Orthodox, reduce the cost of living, and return to peace talks with the Palestinians. Such pledges, while often made in Israeli politics, are not always followed through on. Sound familiar? Or Netanyahu could create a narrow coalition with the Orthodox parties and a couple of defectors from the centrists and simply keep going the direction he's gone the past 4 years. This seems less likely. But in Israeli politics, who knows? All of this political ferment continues to demonstrate that Israeli democracy is very much alive and well. 64% of all eligible Israelis voted last week, in contrast to America's recent presidential election turnout of about 57%. It also shows that the huge Israeli economic protest movements of the summer of 2011, and to a lesser extent of last summer, have now taken root in a particular political party, and now have the capacity to influence the direction of policy in Israel. After all the Israeli electioneering, there is one thing that is abundantly clear. There is a future for Israel, apparently, and it prominently includes a new political star, Yair Lapid. And, to play us in on the theme of tomorrow in Israel, Evyatar Banai's beautiful song, Ad Machar, Until Tomorrow.
כשאת כל כך עייפה צי לטיול לעוזריך רחוקה מהבית בשביל לחזור נמחק הולכת על חבל דק הלילות ארוכים בלי לדעת למה בורחת ואין נקיף את הפארק רק להפסיק לחשוב אנשים עייפים רצים ברחוב היינו פה כבר קודם בתפקיד הפוך הליכה מהירה
That was Evyatar Banai singing Ad Mahar, Until Tomorrow, in tribute to the results of last week's Israeli election and Yesh Atid. You know, at Hanukkah this year, there was a huge international media Jewish story about the Women of the Wall, a group that has been praying at the Kotel, the Western Wall of Jerusalem, for something like 24 years. They were illegally prevented from wearing prayer shawls, talitot, at the Kotel, and some were even detained by police. The most prominent of them, my friend Rabbi Elise Frischman, is an accomplished congregational rabbi in America, the editor of the Mishkan Tefillah prayer book of the Reform Movement. When we come back on Two Jewish, Rabbi Elise Frischman will tell us the story of just what happened that day at the Western Wall and what it means for all Jews. Meet her in a few moments on Two Jewish.
There's nothing like a live radio show to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the Two Jewish Radio Show featuring Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends. It's live at the Fox Theater on March 2nd.
Better than Prairie Home Companion, it's Deli Home Companion. Join me and my great guests, including Richard Lewis, for a live radio variety show to benefit Jewish Family and Children's Services, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and Temple Emmanuel. Saturday night, March 2nd at the Fox.
Tickets at the box office and foxtucsontheater.org or learn about sponsorship opportunities by calling 327-4501.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Rabbi Elise Frischman. She's a senior rabbi at Barnard Temple in New Jersey. She's the editor of the Reform Movement's Mishkan Tefillah, one of the most prominent Reform rabbis in America. I could say the world, if you'd like. And she had a really dramatic experience recently in Jerusalem that you may have seen in the world media all over the place. Good morning, Elise. Welcome.
Good morning, Sam.
So, we'll talk more about Women of the Wall a little later in the show, in the main interview, but tell us sort of what your immediate impression was. What's your big takeaway out of this experience?
So many of us traveled to Jerusalem, and one of the highlights of our experiences is to be able to go to the Western Wall. It's the site of the first and second temples of our people, and this retaining wall has become for us so symbolic of our prayers, our hopes, our vision. And Jews all over the world come there regularly to put a little piece of paper, a prayer, into the wall and to just be able to stand there and feel connected to Jews, not only there but around the world. And I came and have come so many times with my prayers and my hopes and my dreams, and this time came, and because I was wearing a tallis, a Jewish prayer shawl, I was forcibly removed from this place and brought to a police station. And shocked is barely the word that reflects my feelings and then the ensuing experience.
So
the Kotel, which we've talked about many times on this show, many of the listeners are familiar with, you know, the holiest place in the world for Jews, men and women. And it's a place where Jews go to pray, do bar mitzvahs, many other ritual experiences take place there. And yet, is there a law that says women can't wear a tallis, a prayer shawl, at the wall?
This is actually contestable. Let me back up a moment and suggest that when we talk about having bar mitzvahs there, we are not talking about having bat mitzvahs there.
Of course.
And mothers, of course, may not stand with their sons. So there are many issues related to gender here at the Kotel. The issue of wearing a tallis, in my opinion, is not a matter of law, but it was a matter of decree. And there is a difference. There is no Israeli law preventing women from wearing a tallis. And in fact, women have been wearing tallis in there, and there was actually permission given to women to wear their tallis a certain way so that it didn't resemble a man's tallis. But on the day that I was there, all of that changed.
Well, we'll hear a great deal more about that when we come back with our guest, Rabbi Elise Frischman, on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona income taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime by directing your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Here's how. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations who provide scholarships for kids in kindergarten through 12th grade to go to qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, Temple Emmanuel's Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income tax and make your contribution to JETCO, you'll get 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax return. Join over 750 supporters last year who gave money to JETCO and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income tax. New this year, there's an additional tax credit, the switcher credit. It increases the maximum donation you can make to JETCO to $1,003 for single filers and $2,006 for married couples filing jointly. When we fight every day for the continuity of the Jewish people, take advantage of this great opportunity. JETCO is one way to foster a Jewish identity for our community's kids. Contributions to JETCO have helped hundreds of children receive financial aid in order to get a Jewish education. Call 647-8442, again, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Give the gift of education. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. You can see and hear Rabbi Arthur Green, last week's Two Jewish guest and one of the most important scholars and teachers of Jewish mysticism, at the Rabbi Albert T. Bilgrey Lectureship at the University of Arizona and Temple Emmanuel, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, February 7th, 8th, and 9th. Rabbi Green's overall topic is Kabbalah, Hasidism, and Spirituality at the U of A on Thursday night at 7 p.m., at Temple Emmanuel at 7:30 p.m. on Friday night, and at noon on Saturday. Call 327-4501 for more information or visit templeemmanueltucson.org. All events of the Bilgrey Lectureship are free and open to the public. In preparation for our gigantic live show celebration of the 10th anniversary of Too Jewish at the Fox Theater on Saturday night, March 2nd, we are playing some previews of the terrific comedian Richard Lewis, who will star that night. Here he is talking about dressing rather like a science fiction actor and about Woodstock or not going to Woodstock with Craig Ferguson.
I happen to be a Jew, Bob Dylan said. Well, I didn't hear it properly on concert. It was, but when I read the lyrics, it was, I was born here and I'll die here against my will. Very profound. And I popped out a Jew and I was on the Enterprise and they threw me off. Because I, you know, they're a little anti-Semitic on that.
No, they are not.
I wanted to have my bar mitzvah on the Enterprise, and they said, get off, and that was the end of it.
Had I gone
to Woodstock, and I was like 17, and they beat the horn, I was born in Brooklyn, I was living in Jersey, and they said, come on, Hendrix, and every, you know, I couldn't believe it. And I walked out the door, I swear to God, I went, I don't know, it's drizzling. And I didn't go to Woodstock.
You didn't go to Woodstock
because
it was drizzling?
Yeah, so I went down to Englewood, New Jersey, where I was raised. Well, raised is a stretch. Really, Possum would have done a better job raising me. But I went.
You were raised by possums? Where does it say this?
No, I'm saying my family, they were clueless. They didn't have a clue. But, you know, where was I? Oh.
You were being raised by possums on your way to Woodstock.
No, but I didn't go to Woodstock.
The possums wouldn't let you. The cruel possum king kept you in his domain.
That's exactly right.
That's exactly what happened.
That was comedian Richard Lewis, a very funny man who will be here March 2nd at the Fox Theater for the 10th anniversary live show of Too Jewish. Don't miss it. Join us by getting tickets at Fox Tucson Theater, theatre.org, for a fantastic evening. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center here in Tucson. Good morning, Guy. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So we have some visitors coming who can help us learn about Israel.
That is true. We have a very special visitor. His name is Gil Cohen McGinn. He is a very famous photographer in Israel. But his, let's say, the crown of his work, or the cherry on top of the cream of his work, was an 8 years study that he did on the most extreme ultra-Orthodox communities in Israel, the Hasidic courts.
The real Haredim, the deep Haredim.
The deep Haredim, the most traditional, most observant, and often the parts of the society that even Israelis don't really know. He was able, in a very long process, to build relationships with those communities and to get to the point where they actually allow him to take photos of their ceremonies, traditions, different aspects of their lives, which is really unique. And in his talk that will take place at the JCC on Monday, January 28th at 7 p.m. By the way, the talk is free and open for all, and everybody are invited.
Absolutely.
In his talk, he will share this experience with us. He will walk us through this magical journey with his photos on the huge screen at the JCC, where we can see those ceremonies. And he'll tell us what took place there. How did he get to take those photos? What's the story behind them?
Now, how does someone get access to quite a closed community?
That is a very fascinating element, and he will share that in his talk. I need to admit, even I can't really understand before I would hear him how he made it, because usually those communities are very suspicious of any outsider. As an Israeli, as a secular Israeli, it would be even challenging for me to walk down their streets, because they immediately, it's kind of going into a very observant, sorry for the comparison, but a very observant Amish community as an outsider. Everybody looks at you, everybody, you know, they know straight away that you're not from there, that you're an outsider.
Well, and they have beards like the Amish, so...
They have some other stuff, I think, that are...
They got the hats,
well,
coats, that's all right. I do think it's fascinating because, after all, these are Jews of deep conviction, experiencing life in a very different way from most of us, and I think interesting not only for Jews, but for anybody in the community.
I agree. So again, it will be Monday, January 28th at 7 p.m. at the JCC, Gil Cohen McGinn Lecture.
Thanks very much, Guy. We will look forward to seeing you there.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Tom, we've been talking about the Holocaust, the use of the Holocaust, the Shoah, politically, culturally, educationally. Let's talk about art a little bit. It's been in the news some with a guy using some ashes from Majdanek in a painting, which seems horrific to everybody. He did it really to try to demonstrate something terrible about the Holocaust. But the art of the Holocaust has been controversial since people started to try to interpret the experience. I think of Theodore Adorno, the poet writing after World War II, there can be no poetry after Auschwitz, and then all the Holocaust poems coming out immediately afterwards, trying to contradict that.
Plus other forms of literature. I mean, the whole after Auschwitz theology, that very famous play, The Deputy.
Right. Right. Well, and then Elie Wiesel's
Hochul, right.
All of that come pouring out.
Right. So that's all various forms of art which use, again, in quotation marks, the Holocaust in different ways. I mean, I think there's a certain grossness and disrespect to using physical parts of the Holocaust, like the ashes of a human being or even the eyeglasses of a victim in art. It's very different from using the theme or the fact of the event in art.
You know, the Lord knows how many stacks of shoes they've shown in various artworks, but they weren't the actual shoes of victims. Somehow that crosses a line.
Right. I think, you know, such a big tragedy needs to be treated with respect, even reverence. On the other hand, you know, it's the biggest things in life and in history that form the substance, the soul of art. I mean, for art to be moving, it has to be relevant. And for millions and millions of people, the Holocaust is relevant, either personally or historically or in terms of family, in terms of peoplehood, in terms of community, or in terms of, and we often forget this as Jews, it happened in our backyard. How could our people let this happen? How could our neighbors turn their heads away?
In the most civilized countries of the world, supposedly.
Right. So this has caused, thankfully, a lot of serious soul searching, and that, I think, is the genesis of good art, is discomfort, questioning, how could this happen, and trying to come to terms with that. So, I mean, I don't have a problem with literature, painting, music,
theater, movies, right,
based on the Holocaust and an attempt to come to terms with how did this happen, how did we let it happen, or how did we let ourselves be victims. I think those are all legitimate questions, which will never be finally answered to everybody's satisfaction. I think those will be sort of eternal questions. And I think also the whole educational aspect of the museums and the tours we talked about last time and some of the literature and art we're talking about now is also the Holocaust is sort of a paradigm for any kind of genocide and maybe can be used in the future to help sensitize people to the possibility of genocide and the necessity to do all we can to prevent genocide in our generation with whatever group might be the victim.
You know, great art brings out our common humanity, and even great art about the Holocaust, perhaps, not even, especially great art about the Holocaust needs to bring out that aspect.
Right, right.
Tom, thanks. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Rabbi Gold is ill and is admitted to the hospital. The next day, Max, the temple's president, goes to visit. Rabbis, says Max, I'm here on behalf of our board of trustees. They've asked me to bring you their good wishes for a speedy recovery and their hope you should live to be 120. Thank you, says Rabbi Gold. I'm pleased to hear of their good wishes for me. And so you should be, Rabbi, says Max. It was close, but the final vote was 11-9. That was the old Jewish Joke of the Week special feature of Two Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the Torah portion of Yitro, the great moment of the revelation at Mount Sinai, which includes the climactic events of the Ten Commandments and the Theophany at Sinai, the most direct revelation of all. It's a testament to brevity and concision, just a few paragraphs that form the core of Western ethical thought. It is these words that have become the essence of the religious experience in the West ever since. Important stuff. But I have to note that in today's world, the whole concept of revelation is complex and challenging. Do you personally believe in revelation at all? That is, that God reveals God's great power, will, and plan to us directly? Skeptics, which at heart includes a lot of us, easily can highlight a series of improbabilities in the central tale of this epical Jewish narrative of revelation. First, are we to actually believe that at Mount Sinai God revealed God's own essence? That somehow, in some supernatural way, a group of freed Israelite slaves communicated directly with a being much greater than themselves, and that this only happened once, and that more than 3,000 years ago? Are we supposed to believe that not only did these Israelites think God connected with them, but that God spoke actual words, that our ancestors not only understood them, but memorized them? Clearly, our tradition teaches that there have been moments of overwhelming connection to God, and the greatest of these is this Ma'amad Har Sinai, the event of standing at Sinai, which would have happened if it did about 3,200 years ago. Our ancestors certainly believed that this really happened, that a certain covenant, a moral contract, was created in that spectacular set of moments. Today, there are other ways we can view revelation. While the text of Parshat Yitro, this week's portion in Exodus, sees the events at Sinai as a unique experience, filled with dramatic pronouncements, lightning, thunder, earthquakes, and shofars going off, Jewish tradition has always taught that each of us stood at Sinai, including every generation of Jew not yet born. In other words, we're all participants in revelation in our own way. Just as we all must see ourselves as having come out of Egypt as freed slaves, so we all must come to understand our relationship with God directly. God's revelation, God's will revealed to us in our own lives, has to be given to us and accepted by each of us directly. My grandfather, the rabbi and professor Samuel S. Kohan, had a concept of progressive revelation, that each of us in every generation has the ability to conceive of and perceive God in his or her own way. Moses' generation called it the revelation at Sinai. Our generation might call it inspiration, divine inspiration, or even just creativity, a way to channel the divine energy that flows through our world always and sometimes gifts us with a spark of greatness or genius. Could that be revelation for you? Maybe. When we feel that remarkable connection to the universe that allows us to create, to write, to sing, to play music, to dance, to really love, we are experiencing a kind of revelation. In those moments, God is revealed to us in the holiness we can touch in our own lives. Revelation might simply mean knowing God's presence through beauty, inspiration, and care. And this essential understanding can bring special meaning to everything we do. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Elise Frischman, one of the most prominent Reform rabbis in America, will tell us what really happened to her at the Western Wall back in December, who the women of the wall are, and why it should matter to every one of us. Find out when we return on To Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community.
Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470. We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
For the first time since its establishment, the European Union has incorporated International Holocaust Remembrance Day, that is today, January 27th, into its official calendar. I'm delighted that, with our partners in the European Parliament, we have managed to place such an important event on the official EU calendar, said European Jewish Communities President Moshe Kantor. Remembering the Holocaust is a massive undertaking, not least in a time when survivors are becoming fewer and anti-Semitism and intolerance are rising, especially in Europe, he could have added. Furthermore, with the political gains of the far-right neo-Nazi parties in European parliaments, the fact that this event is warmly embraced by all the most prominent European institutions sends a strong message against hate, racism, and anti-Semitism. January 27th was designated as a memorial day at the UN General Assembly back in 2005. That was the date the Soviet troops liberated the Auschwitz death camp in 1945. The National Jewish Book Awards were announced for the 2012 year, and a number of Two Jewish guests are prominently featured, including Professor Jonathan Sarna, Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz, Professor Bernard Wasserstein, Rabbi David Ellenson, Rabbi Sandy Eisenberg Sasso, and Ben Sidran. Apparently, we have really great taste in literature here on Two Jewish. Clearly, we've been taking the right advice.
Dear Abby, my feet are too long. My hair's falling out, my rights are all wrong. My friends, they all tell me that I'm no friends at all. Won't you write me a letter? Won't you give me a call? Signed, Bewildered. Bewildered, bewildered, you have no complaint. You are what you are, and you ain't what you ain't. So listen up, Buster, listen up good. Stop wishing for bad luck and knocking on wood.
Dear Abby, I've always wanted to have my family history traced, but I couldn't afford to spend a lot of money to do it. Do you have any suggestions? MJB in Oakland, California. Dear MJB, yes, run for public office. 60 years ago, Pauline Phillips, a Jewish housewife, was looking for something more meaningful than Mahjong to do with her life, so she transformed herself into the syndicated columnist Dear Abby, and in so doing became a trusted, tart-tongued advisor to tens of millions. She died last week at the age of 94. If Damon Runyon and Groucho Marx had gone jointly into the advice column, theirs would have read much like Dear Abby's, I think. With her comic and flinty but sympathetic voice, Phillips helped wrestle the advice column from a Victorian past into the hard-nosed 20th century. Perhaps she was influenced as well by the Yiddish advice columns of the old-time forewords like a Bintel Brief. Who knows? In any case, Phillips invented Abigail Van Buren in 1956 and quickly became known for her astringent, sometimes genteelly risque replies to queries about marital, medical, and, well, sometimes both kinds of questions, like, Dear Abby, are birth control pills deductible? Signed, Bertie. Dear Bertie, only if they don't work. Dear Abby was also known for her long, much-publicized professional rivalry with her identical twin sister, the advice columnist Ann Landers. Long before the internet and long before the pervasive electronic confessionals of Dr. Ruth, Phil, Laura, and so on, the Dear Abby column was a forum for the public discussion of private problems, read by many millions of people in hundreds of newspapers around the world.
Dear Abby,
no
The youngest of four sisters, Pauline Esther Friedman, was born in Sioux City, Iowa on the 4th of July, 1918. Her twin sister, Esther Pauline Friedman, beat her into the world by 17 minutes, just as she would narrowly beat her into the advice business, but not, you know, overwhelm her exactly. Their father, Abraham, was a Jewish immigrant from Vladivostok, Russia, who got his start in the U.S. as an itinerant chicken peddler, and in a typical American success story, ended up owning a chain of movie theaters. The twin future advisors attended Morningside College in Sioux City. They both studied journalism and psychology and wrote a joint gossip column for the college paper. As close as they were, the intense competitiveness that would later spill into the public arena was apparent early. She wanted to be the first violin in the school orchestra, but I was, Phillips told Life magazine back in 1958. She swore she'd marry a millionaire, but I did. In 1939, Pauline Friedman left college, marrying Morton Phillips, an heir to a liquor fortune. She was married in a lavish double ceremony with her sister, who, not to be outdone, married Jules Lederer, then a salesman, but ultimately the guy who founded Budget Rent-A-Car. In 1955, Eppie Lederer, Phillips' twin, took over the Ann Landers column for the Chicago Sun-Times. A rank beginner, she was soon swamped by the flood of mail and started sending batches of letters to her twin sister, you know, for advice. I provided the sharp answers, Phillips said in 1981. I'd say you're writing too long, and this is the way I'd say it. My stuff was published, and it looked awfully good in print. So good that when the Sun-Times later forbade Lederer to send letters out of the office, Phillips, now living in the Bay Area, decided to find her own column. She called the San Francisco Chronicle, said she was a local housewife who thought she could do better than the advice columnist the paper had. Well, if you're in the neighborhood, the features editor said, come in and see me. Phillips took him at his word, and the next morning appeared unannounced in the newsroom wearing a Christian Dior dress. She had prudently left her chauffeured Cadillac around the corner. Just to get rid of her, the editor handed her a stack of back issues, telling her to compose her own replies to the letters in the advice column. She did so in characteristic style, dropped off her answers at the paper, and got a phone call. The job was hers, paying $20 a week. Phillips chose her own pen name, taking Abigail from the prominent figure, the wife of David, in the Book of Samuel. Then David said to Abigail, "Blessed is your advice, and blessed are you." And she chose Van Buren because it sounded vaguely presidential. Dear Abby first appeared January 9, 1956, less than 3 months after her sister had debuted. Dear Abby, our son married a girl when he was in the military. They were married in February, and she had an 8.5-pound baby girl in August. She said the baby was premature. Can an 8.5-pound baby be premature? Wanting to know. Dear Wanting, the baby was on time. The wedding was late. Forget it. An immediate success, the column was quickly syndicated, but with her growing renown, Dear Abby also had a growing estrangement from her twin. Dear Abby and Ann Landers battled for syndication for years. The sisters did not actually speak for about 5 years, finally reconciling in the mid-60s. Lederer Ann Landers died in 2002 at the age of 83. Now Dear Abby has followed her. May their memory bring blessing. Advice will never be quite the same. Now will it? And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world.
We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Rabbi Elise Frischman. It's always nice to have good friends on the show.
It's a pleasure to be with you and to even see you, Sam.
Thank you. Rabbi Frischman is the... I want to call you Elise. I'm sorry. She is the senior rabbi of Barnard Temple in New Jersey. She's the editor of the Reform Movement's Mishkan Tefillah Prayer Book, has served in many important roles for the Reform Movement over the years, and recently was involved, as we said a little bit earlier in the show, in a very important incident at the Wall. I'd like to back up a little bit and talk about the group, the Women of the Wall. We've had Anat Hoffman on, who was obviously integral in that group, but tell us a little bit about what Women of the Wall are, is, and how it works.
Women of the Wall is a group of primarily Israeli women, 50% of whom are Orthodox women. And these are women who have wanted to pray like all Jews want to pray at the wall, in their way. And for these women, that means being able to stand, as all women do, in the women's section at the wall. There is a separation between men and women. But to be able to pray with their prayers, in their voices aloud, to be able to sing as all people sing in prayer, and to be able to wear the ritual items of Jewish prayer, a kippah, tefillin, which are leather straps containing the prayer that is also within the mezuzah, and to wear a tallit. For quite a long time, these women have been harassed, and the group, which has been in existence for 24 years, about 12 years ago, began petitioning the Supreme Court for permission to formally be able to pray at the wall without harassment and to be able to read Torah at the wall. So about 6 years ago, the Supreme Court, in this landmark pronouncement, determined that the women of the wall would be allowed to come to the wall to pray. They would not be allowed to read Torah there because it would be too much of a distraction for more traditionally observant Jews, but that they would be able to bring this Torah down to another section of the Western Wall, which is
Robinson's Arch area, around the corner.
Right. Well, it's not so much around the corner as much as the lower level of that same retaining wall. And so that was good news. The interesting thing, though, is that the Supreme Court determined that the women would be allowed to do this one day each month and during a certain period of time on that month, that during that day and time, that they would not, therefore, be a distraction to other people. And so,
it's like a weird version of a Hasidic story.
I believe it is, in some ways, a Hasidic story, in the sense that it is very, very much determined by the Haredi, the ultra-Orthodox rabbinate of Israel, and in this case, the chief rabbi of the wall. I had brought with me a special tallis to wear. So early that morning, we woke up at around 5 because we needed to get there very early because that's the prescribed time for the women to be able to pray at the wall. I was searching through my luggage for my tallis, and I couldn't find it because I was jet-lagged, and I'm pulling things out, and I didn't have all that much, and I just couldn't find it. So I said to Anat, I feel so badly, Anat. I know I brought my tallis with me, but I can't find it. She said, Elise, let me give you, you can borrow the tallis that we have, the Women of the Wall tallis, which is a special tallis designed specifically to actually help raise money for Women of the Wall. And it has the some embroidery on each of the four corners that are the four matriarchs, Sarah, Rebecca
Rachel, and Leah.
So I thought, okay, I'll wear this tallis. As we're making our way to the Old City and to the Western Wall, she said to me, look, the chief rabbi has been making random decrees over the last several months.
So the chief rabbi of the wall.
Correct. One month he decreed we couldn't wear our tallises. We think this morning he's going to say that we can't bring in our prayer books. So I said, so what do we do? She said, Elise, be strong. Just, you know how to talk your way out of it. Just bring the prayer books in. I said, okay. I said, what do we do about our tallises? She said, look, they told us that we can't wear our tallises if they look like male tallises. I said, do you mean like the fabric? She said, well, that, and we can't wear it exactly like men. We have to wear it kind of wrapped around our necks like scarves, and then they won't bother us. I said, okay. Not happy, but okay. This is your game, not mine. I'm here to support you.
I'm visiting.
Exactly. I'm an observer.
Right.
So I took the tallis and I wrapped it around my head like a scarf, and I zipped up my jacket around it so you couldn't see my tallis. People are going through the line. As the women are going through one by one, their tallises are being confiscated. And the police are even starting to tell women, unbutton your jacket, unzip your jacket, and remove those tallises. For whatever reason, I got through. Now, let's keep in mind, the police. Why are the police doing this? This is a religious matter. The police are there for security issues. Why is this a security issue? I make my way.
What they claim later, of course, is that it's provocative, but Women of the Wall have been praying at the wall now for 24 years.
So I make my way to the wall, and there are, at this point, about 20, 25 of us gathered there. And I take my tallis outside of my jacket and I drape it over my shoulders. One young woman comes up to me and she says, very quietly, would it be all right if I stand and pray next to you because I'm afraid to wear my tallit? I was shocked. Absolutely, I said. Within 30 seconds, a policeman came over to me and he told me to remove my tallis, and I refused. He said, you must. I said, why? There is no law against this. He took my arm and he steered me away. And I, along with three other women, two of the young 18-year-olds, part of that...
The Netzer group,
and an Israeli Orthodox woman who is a formal member of Women of the Wall, the four of us were taken off to the police station. And there we were held for 3 hours. We were interrogated individually. We were not allowed to use our cell phones. We were not allowed to text. We were not allowed to talk. It was all a process of intimidation. Our passports were taken. We were fingerprinted. We were photographed. I had done nothing wrong. I had broken no law. At the very end of it, the woman who is interrogating me finishes her interrogation, looks at me, beams a broad smile, and says, you are free to go. So, as a result of all this, it became very, very clear that there is a process of intimidation going on that is all meant... It's clear that the chief rabbi really, really does not understand why these women want to pray the way they want to pray. He really does see and believe that Anat and all of these women are purely provocateurs, that their only goal is to be disruptive, that they are angry, that they have no sense of what Judaism really is. It is a funnel vision view of Judaism that he has. And so part of our responsibility is, in a way, to ignore him. And to say, this is not an issue that has any relevancy to the chief rabbi of the wall. This is an issue for Jews, frankly, around the world, who want to be able to pray the way we pray everywhere else. The policewoman said to me in her interrogation, do you always wear a tallit when you come to pray at the wall? And I said, always. She said, do you always wear a tallit when you pray? Incredulously. And by the way, why is this her question? And my answer was, of course I do. Because of my title and my stature, you know, I became a wonderful symbolic token. And so from this really, you know, this position of observer, suddenly I was catapulted into this position of what could be done now about this. And so for that, I'm very, very grateful.
It's a remarkable story. And, you know, as so often happens in remarkable stories, there's an element of serendipity, you know, a little bit of Bashirat, that it was you that were there. I invite people to, if they want to find out more information, research Women of the Wall. I believe there's a website they can go to.
There's also several YouTubes. There was a young woman who, again, serendipitously happened to pull out her iPhone as we were being detained and videoed. I didn't even realize
it. Yeah, your whole conversation was audible, hopefully even as well as it is on the radio show right now.
That's right.
So then go to YouTube and look it up. You can research. You look it up by your name, Elise Frishman, ElyseFrishman.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you very much, Elise, for a great visit, and we'll do it again sometime.
I appreciate your support.
My pleasure. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for joining us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Come back next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be A.O. Oppenheimer, the creator of the brand new and wild website called Sensually Jewrotica. Postponed from today, but, you know, probably worth the wait. Our playout this morning comes from Israeli singer Rona Kenan, her lovely Einayim Zarot, Through Foreign Eyes. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
אבל האור שבפנים דמה מדי לשלי, רציתי להדוף את השנים. שעומדות בינינו בלי להבין שאין כלי נשק בעולם שרק מתוקף אהבתי יכריע את הזמן אני לא אפסיק לרצות אני לא אפסיק לרצות אני לא אקנע לרעיון הזה שאי אפשר כי אי אפשר ואי אפשר זה עניין של הישרדות גם אם תגידי לי שדי כבר ונגמר אין לי ברירה אלא לרצות את האפשר